Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 6th December with me, Ian Welsh. When I was at the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum in London last month, I moderated a conference session where we considered the balance for smallholder farmers between conservation and farm livelihoods, and the role of business and its partners in getting this balance right. It was a fascinating session, and immediately following it I recorded an interview with the session panellists, Emily Coonan from Nestle, Gotts Martin from Golden Agri Resources, and Roisin Mortimer from Earthworm Foundation. Highlights from that conversation are coming up, but first is the regular roundup of some sustainable business news. Soy has never been such big news. This week, a group of dozens of major international brands, retailers and investors wrote to the Brazilian government calling for an extension of the Amazon soy moratorium, the agreement signed in 2006 by companies to ban the development of new land to grow soy in the Amazon. Some of the world's largest retail chains are signatories, including Tesco, Carrefour, Sainsbury's and Aldi, alongside producers such as Mars, Dutch investor Robeco and BMO Global Asset Management from Canada. The letter is, on the face of it, partly prompted by a move from the Brazilian Soy Farmers Association to end the ban on soy from newly cleared land. Brazil is the world's largest soy exporter, shipping 6.3 million tonnes in 2016-17. The majority of this goes to China, whose dependence on Brazil for soy has increased thanks to the tariffs imposed on imports from the US thanks to the Trump trade war. The impact of agriculture will no doubt feature significantly at the UN COP25 climate talks in Madrid now underway. We'll look at some of the outcomes in the next couple of weeks. An announcement that was widely welcomed was the appointment of current Governor of the Bank of England, the UK Central Bank, Mark Carney, as the new UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance. He will take up his pro bono post once his term as Bank Governor comes to an end on the 31st of January 2020. Earlier this week, the Climate Group released its annual Progress and Insights report and revealed that the number of businesses and organisations committed to using 100% renewable energy had jumped to over 200 in 2019, with an average target date of 2028. New sign-ups this year include Gap, 3M, Ralph Lauren, Barclays and Virgin Media. One in three of the signatories to the Climate Group's RE100 scheme already are able to use renewables to meet 75% of their energy needs. At the recent United Nations Forum on Business and Human Rights in Geneva, a focus was the continued push for member countries to introduce national action plans. To date, 22 plans have been adopted, with 23 more in development. These plans are designed to promote a joined-up approach coordinating government at all levels in each country. The UN Forum came soon after the launch of a new Centre for Business and Human Rights at the University of Geneva. The centre will help integrate human rights into business school programmes at the university, involving different industry sectors. Finally this week, news that the Swedish apparel chain H&M is backing innovative UK-based biotech startup Colorifix, which is developing a method of textile dyeing that uses microbes to deposit and fix pigments onto fabric. Conventional dyeing processes involve large amounts of hazardous chemicals, including chromium and heavy metal compounds, consuming huge amounts of energy and water. Wastewater pollution is a particular concern for the sector. Colorifix says that its microbe-based method cuts water use by up to 90%, is carried out at lower temperatures, and uses no hazardous chemicals. The company's process involves harvesting a colour gene and inserting it into a bacterial cell, and then making it fill with colour and duplicate. The cells combine with fabric, releasing the colour onto it in the dyeing process. If trials currently underway, including with H&M, are successful, Colorifix expects to launch commercially during 2020. Innovation Forum's 2020 programme is taking shape. On the 18th and 19th of March, we'll be back in London for the Ethical Trade and Human Rights Forum. Our New York Human Rights and Business event is on the 5th and 6th of May, and discounts of $500 in two-day passes are available if you register before 13th December, next week. On the 28th and 29th April, we'll be back in Amsterdam for the next in our Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference series, and we will be convening the 2020 Future of Food US Forum in Minneapolis on the 27th and 28th of May, and we'll be holding the London Future of Food event on the 2nd and 3rd of June. Check out the Innovation Forum website for full details. When I was in London last month at Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum, I sat down with Emily Coonan, Responsible Sourcing Lead at Nestle, Gotts Martin, Head of Sustainability Implementation at Golden Agri Resources, and Roisin Mortimer, Project Manager at the Earthworm Foundation. And we talked about collaboration to help balance smallholder farmer conservation and income. Emily, why don't you kick us off and tell us a little bit about this case study project you've got in Indonesia?
So this project came out of our effort to be more inclusive of smallholders in our supply chain. And we have historically done a lot of initiatives with smallholders that are really focused on livelihoods, on resiliency. And at the same time, we've had a lot of initiatives in our palm oil responsible sourcing work around forests and making sure there's no deforestation in our supply chain. But more recently, we've been looking closer at the patterns of deforestation around our supply chains and seeing the link between smallholders and deforestation or small clearance patterns, and realizing that we need to take a really integrated approach to addressing livelihoods issues and forest protection within the same project. And so this project in Indonesia, in Sumatra, is one example of where we're working with our supplier GAR, with our partner Earthworm Foundation, to try and tackle that complex issue.
So for you then, what have been the key challenges for this project?
Yeah, so the key challenge for us was, we were approaching the project from the traceability angle. For us, it was important to understand where does our supply come from. And when we were working with Earthworm, they spent quite a lot of time there in the field, 6 months, and we identified all the farmers. What was very interesting finding for us was, A, that the productivity of these people were very low and hardly enough to survive, and therefore was a serious or a real threat that these people continue to expand their fields into forested areas. So deforestation, which would be associated with our supply chain. And then secondly, was that the Indonesian land classification system classified some of these farmers to be located within the Indonesian forest estate where they are not supposed to be because there should be trees, completely ignoring the real land cover. And so to be able to continue to have these people being part of our supply chain, we needed an approach on how to, in parentheses, legalize these farmers.
Roisin, for you, what have been the key challenges of this project, and then what's made you most excited about the project?
I guess the challenges for us just largely linked to what Dr. said was around trying to clarify the land tenure on the ground to then look at land use planning. So we couldn't really dive into some of the participatory land use planning that we saw there was a big need for without actually clarifying who owns which piece of land, what the government recognizes as agricultural or forest, and if where there's people who've maybe been coming in from other areas, what kind of land rights do they have? Now that we have actually gone through a lot of that and that the request for approval of the land ownership sits with quite a senior level of government, and we've made a lot of progress developing this participatory land use plan, one of the big challenges that remains is how can we continue to ensure that that land use plan is respected? And obviously people may have all agreed to something, and we really think that this project has been really involving the local community from the beginning. It's really been based off what they've identified as what they want to do, which is fantastic. But then that can change, right? Like people sometimes want different things in 5 years, or they change their mind, or it's their son or their daughter takes over the land, or they marry into a different family. So I think that's a big challenge for the future of the project.
Why is uncertainty over who owns what such a problem? Guts.
It results in many conflicts, normally. Conflicts is a big issue. It will be very difficult to help people out of poverty if there is questions who owns this land. There is a lot of land trades going on. And to have that security for us, that we are essentially investing into the right landowner, is quite critical.
From Nestle's perspective, why again is the kind of land tenure issue so important? Is it because it's not legal? If it's not, you don't know who owns it?
It starts with the issue of legality. Of course, we're looking for all actors in our supply chain to be legal. And then on top of that, a lot of the work that we're looking to do to ensure more resilient livelihoods and better incomes for the people in our supply chain, it's really dependent on being able to, you know, have access to services or to be able to maybe get loans or whatnot. And a lot of these aspects come back to, do you have legal right to the land that you're on?
Incentives, getting incentives right, is something that has come up an awful lot over the last couple of days here at the conference. So from Nestle's perspective, again, let's go down the supply chain. So from Nestle's perspective, how do you work to ensure that the incentives for everybody involved in supplying your products are right? How do you get that value chain correct?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most complex topics because there's not one right incentive everywhere. Really critical is to actually know the supply chain, so know where the product's coming from, understand who is it that's involved, what are their challenges, what is it that they're looking for, and to be able to really develop solutions that are quite tailored to that context, which is, of course, challenging to do at scale. And I think increasingly we're seeing that to really get this right, it takes having the right people on the ground and enough people on the ground to really build the relationships throughout the supply chain to get the incentive balance right.
From Earthworm's perspective, what do you do to help your partners line the incentives up correctly so they work for everybody?
I mean, I think one thing is that this word incentives is thrown around a lot. And what's important is that we identifying what do the people that we're trying to incentivize, what do they want? What are they or and if they're encroaching on forests, why is that? I don't think it's because they get a thrill out of going and cutting down trees. It's because it's linked to, maybe it is a traditional shifting agriculture practice. Maybe it's because there's a low productivity at their field and they're trying to actually clear land to establish a permanent system. So understanding that as a start, and then just to give a few quick tangible examples of what we've done in this project around incentivization is, once we understood those issues from spending 6 months intensively on the ground, is addressing the issues we identified. So improving productivity through agricultural trainings, working with them to build knowledge around organic fertilizers and application, addressing supply chain inefficiencies and turning them into supply chain efficiencies, and of course development of livelihoods diversification and identifying what markets are out there for alternative products, and then conducting trainings to support locals be able to access those markets.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a good point that for the smallholder's perspective, you don't find a smallholder who's wealthy is one who's deforesting. They're doing that because there's no other option for them. So it's a kind of key issue that if they've got the incentives right, if the value is coming to them, then they won't deforest because their farm is working properly. There were some issues that came up in the session. I thought we can round off our interview podcast with those. The issue of contract length came up. Historically or traditionally, everyone seems to think, oh, long-term contracts are definitely the way forward. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it, Gus?
It is complicated, right? Because if you see this landscape in Indonesia, it's not that our mill is not the only mill there. Independent smallholders are, you know, rightly independent, and they have multiple choices to whom they want to sell their product. And so therefore, I don't think that kind of contract arrangements would necessarily change and help people, these smallholders, to become more prosperous. Also in Indonesia, in the case of palm oil, the price is relatively transparent. It's published by the government on a bi-weekly basis and published in local newspapers and in through radio broadcasts. I think it's potentially different in other commodities where this price transparency does not exist. I believe their long-term contracts would be beneficial for the smallholders.
Bringing the smallholders into conversations is another big challenge. And for Nestle, how do you ensure that smallholders are not just sort of passive beneficiaries in the process?
It comes down to trying to select the right partners to work with. Because, of course, as Nestle, as people sitting in Europe or wherever, we're not the right ones to go and to understand. And so that's why we work with partners like Earthworm, like others who have a presence on the ground, who are employing people who are from the smallholder communities themselves, to really have them be co-developers of whatever the initiatives are. Because of that, we're actually, if you look across the smallholder projects that we fund, they're all quite different because they're very responsive to what the needs are in those particular locations.
I think if I may actually jump in here, sure. I think what is quite, we see the same, right? If you work with your local communities, you need to be close to them, you understand them, you hear them, you understand their language. This is very beneficial for whatever you are planning to do. This, however, I think is one of the big challenges what we are facing in scaling up, because it really requires to have lots of people on the ground, get to know them. So there are no or very little quick wins. It's a time and a money investment to be able to scale up and to gain trust of the people.
Actually, yeah, it's just, I think we have to rethink how the supply chains work and what the level of presence is that needs to be on the ground to actually build the relationship between the different tiers of the supply chain and be able to actually have this as an ongoing way of how the supply chain works and not just one-off projects here and there that we hope will inspire scale up somewhere else.
Roisin, for you, what are the key scalability challenges? How can we take this from one mill to thousands of mills?
I think the challenges are endless. It's, as Emily said it, and Gotz have said as well, it just takes a long time to understand and build trust locally, to understand those issues and what's going on, and co-create an action plan or solutions with that community. So having companies willing to fund that long-term work is obviously a big challenge when it may only impact 500 farmers out of 50 or 500,000. So that's a pretty hard sell to anybody. But then there are, I think, what helps that. So I don't know if you want to hear about scale-up solutions is, when we do that and we do all this intensive work for 500 farmers, making sure that we really capture those lessons that we've learned and applying them to the next project, so that hopefully we can speed up the process in the next project or at least reduce the costs required. And then also using things like technology, communications, engaging the government as well once a project is established, so that their extension services are part of sharing the lessons and the solutions. That's a lot of the things that we're looking at the moment.
I think for me, if I may actually throw in, you know, and I take the opportunity to praise Nestle for this. So we are working obviously with a lot of brands, right? And Nestle is one of the rare companies who co-invests in projects on the ground. I think yesterday we had the discussion when we had on the board kind of some keywords on what is expected from brands. I think the big one that was coming out was investment, right? I don't think we see enough investments. There are not many companies like GAR who have the financial strength and also the people and the skills and the capabilities to engage. And so therefore, you know, other organizations who have funds need to come in, make a similar investment like Nestlé does in these landscapes and implement it so we can scale up. Because I think the key is really that companies work with their local mills, plantation owners work with their local communities, which they are very close with. That's who they know, understand, who they can impact. And I think that is the only model to roll out things.
I didn't ask him to say that.
In conclusion, though, for Nestlé then, clearly these sort of projects have a cost. And in this instance, you know, Nestlé is providing a lot of the cost to implement it. But is it because, in fact, this is a security of supply issue? If you don't implement these sorts of plans, ultimately, you're going to lose access to the supply chains that you require for your products.
I think ultimately it comes down to our sustainability commitments and our commitments to responsible palm oil. And this is the only way that we think we'll get there. This isn't the only solution, but we have to really use a combination of tools. These types of projects, satellite monitoring, certification, all have to come together to really transform the supply chains, transform the industry. So I think that's the key driver.
Next year, perhaps we can hear about more case studies and more examples of this thing taking forward. But for now, to Gots, to Roisin and to Emily, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks
for having us.
Remember that there is plenty of content available online at innovationforum.co.uk. Look out in the next few days for the recording of a great webinar discussion we had this week on human rights and auditing with Kima, BAT, Aldo and Twining. All available for free, no paywalls at Innovation Forum. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh and I'll be back next week.